Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Windy conditions in the Bay Area and the return of Santa Ana winds in Southern California today are increasing fears of fire danger, though earlier rains have reduced the threat. The wind's ability to trigger fear and concern, and its contradictory ability to calm and soothe, is partly what drew Simon Winchester to write The Breath of the Gods, about the role the constant wind plays in our lives, its influence on big historical events, and how the wind may be shifting with climate change. Winchester joins us after this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A day after President Trump disparaged the nation of Somalia with words like stinks and garbage, Somali President, rather Prime Minister, Hamza Abdi Barre says it's better not to respond. This is part of what President Trump told reporters at a cabinet meeting yesterday about Somali immigrants in the United States.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Okay? Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country.
In Somalia, long considered a key U.S. ally in the fight against the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, officials are facing public pressure at home and abroad to call out Trump. The U.S. president acknowledges he has leveled similar remarks against other countries, but his rhetoric has repeatedly turned back to the Somali immigrant community, especially one of his most vocal critics in Congress, Representative Ilhan Omar. And now, officials in Minneapolis and St. Paul, home to the largest Somali community in the U.S., are reacting with concern to reports of a planned immigration crackdown in their communities. New Orleans is the latest target of the administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Mel Bridges with member station WWNO reports Customs and Border Patrol officers are now arriving in the city.
The Department of Homeland Security says it's sending federal agents to address, quote, criminal illegal aliens roaming free, and says local authorities are not cooperating with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office is under a federal consent decree which prohibits them from holding people suspected of being in the country illegally beyond their release date. The FBI and Louisiana State Police have rolled out a joint effort to prevent citizens from interfering with federal immigration officers. Other Democratic-led cities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Charlotte have also seen major immigration enforcement efforts. For NPR News, I'm Mel Bridges.
U.S.-Russian negotiations in Moscow aimed at ending the war in Ukraine wrapped up yesterday without significant progress. But, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us, the Ukrainian negotiating team is preparing to meet with Trump's envoy soon.
President Volodymyr Zelensky says his negotiators are in Brussels to brief the Europeans on the U.S.-Russia talks. Then they will prepare for their meeting with U.S. officials. Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the Europeans of trying to thwart President Trump's peace deal by changing the draft proposal to make it unacceptable for Russia. As the talks took place in Moscow, Zelensky addressed the Irish parliament, saying Europe must keep the pressure on Putin.
So that Russia does not believe it will be rewarded for this war with stolen Ukrainian land or thousand kidnapped Ukrainian children.
Analysts say the sides remain too far apart to conclude a peace deal. Eleanor Beard, NPR News, Kyiv.
U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average now up 372 points, or more than 0.75%. It's NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. An AC transit bus crashed into a building in East Oakland, injuring 11 people yesterday afternoon. The crash took place on Foothill Boulevard and 68th Avenue shortly after 1 p.m. Transit officials say an SUV crossed in front of the bus, leading to a crash that sent the bus over a curb and into an auto body shop. Firefighters pulled the bus driver out through one of the vehicle's windows. The driver, 8 passengers on the bus, and 2 people in the SUV were hurt with minor injuries. A new study shows that last winter's massive battery plant fire near Monterey spread a layer of toxic metals across the region. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports.
Scientists from San Jose State University found sharp increases in nickel, manganese, and cobalt in the soil of Elkhorn Slough, a nearby wildlife refuge. The metals, which can be toxic to wildlife and humans, then dispersed with the rain and tides. Ivano Aiello is a professor and chair at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories.
Where it went is one of the good questions, right? Probably runoff took some of the metals in the waterways, but it didn't go completely away. In the longer term, what we're trying to understand is whether it's going to be transferred to the ecosystems.
Many agricultural fields are also close to the Moss Landing battery plant. Vistra Corporation, which operates the plant, did not return a request for comment. I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news on our app and at kqed.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And by the listeners and supporters of KQED. Sacramento Valley, clouds and sun, highs 56 to 62, some gusts up to 40 miles per hour today, decreasing to 30 later. Partly sunny Bay Area and windy too, highs upper 50s to the mid-60s, with gusts up to 45 miles per hour later today, decreasing down to 35 late afternoon.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In his new book, The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind, journalist and author Simon Winchester writes, "Wind is a familiar thing, a thing whose very existence brings a kind of reassurance, yearned for when absent, delighting when gentle, accursed when either biting cold or parching hot, feared when violent. But familiar nonetheless, an ever-present reminder of the living presence of nature and of the planet that is so uniquely bathed in its presence." Listeners, when has the wind either scared or soothed you? Simon Winchester, welcome to Forum.
Well, thank you very much.
Wind, as you say, is universal, constant, and influences the activity of just about every living thing. So you call it an ever-present reminder of the living presence of nature. Is wind's constancy part of what has captivated you so much about it?
I think so. I first experienced a period when there was no wind at all, when I was sailing to the American base in Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and I had started with a friend of mine in a yacht from Cochin in South India, and we sailed down through Sri Lanka and the Maldives, and then suddenly the wind stopped. The sea became like glass, the sails hung impotently from the masts. And that lasted for 2 weeks, and it was searingly hot. Fish would sort of come up and look around and say, no, this is no good, and go back into the sea, because the sea without wind, which didn't move at all, it felt weirdly unnatural. And that was, of course, the doldrums. This part of the area around the equator takes the word doldrums, meaning dull. It was deeply, deeply dull, and felt so strange when there was no movement of air, not even the slightest breath. So I think that first got me to realize that the wind is a delight. I mean, of course we hate it, as I mentioned, or you mentioned there, when it's behaving badly, but we need it and we love it, and it's essential, of course.
The other thing that you talk about a lot is the dual nature of wind, right? And you just sort of express that to some degree now, right? That it can be violent and it can be incredibly soothing, that it can warm us or make us extremely cold, that it can create things and destroy things. So help us appreciate this dual nature of wind in the way that you do.
Well, the British in particular love listening as they go to sleep at night at the end of the BBC broadcasts of the day to what's called the shipping forecast. And I won't get into too technical details, but basically all the sea areas around the British Isles have names which are familiar to us: Dogger, Thames, German Bight, Dover, all the rest of it. And the weather forecast people give specific wind descriptions to all of those areas as we're nodding off to sleep. And becomes, it's poetic in the way they read it. So you're in the bed and the rain is lashing down and you hear it against the window panes and you pull the covers a little bit closer up onto your chin and you think these poor mariners who are looking for cod or whatever out near Iceland are suffering from these astonishing winds which I'm being told about here in the coziness of my bedroom. How courageous they are having to deal with this. Well, good night, I'm going to sleep, and I'm happy that there's very little wind, and my God, what a force they're having. So all the British are attuned to this and enraptured by the fact that the British Isles, as with most places in the world, are surrounded by winds of constant variation and are fascinated as a result.
Yeah. You're reminding me of all the words we have for wind, but also that, as you discovered, not surprisingly, that the places with the most wind have sort of the richest vocabularies. Can you talk about some of the ways we've tried to harness the wind linguistically?
Oh, to harness it? Well, who was it? I think Thor Heyerdahl, the great explorer of the Pacific, mentioned quite sagely that man hoisted the first sail before he saddled the first horse. And you can imagine that. I mean, the first word ever written denoting the wind was in Sumerian. So we're talking about 4,500 years BCE. So a long time ago. Before that, it was literally ascribed in conversation, because there was no written language then, as being to do with the gods. Now, all of a sudden, the Sumerians have a name for it. Ili is the word. It's odd. It's rather like that coffee, which the coffee manufacturers don't know how old their word is. And it's denoted in cuneiform by three horizontal lines, which are a bit like the swoosh in a Nike running shoe. So the Mesopotamians were the first to denote wind in written language. And you can imagine them trekking between the Tigris and the Euphrates, coming to the great barrier presented by the Euphrates River, seeing a log floating down it. Maybe some courageous fellow thought, I'll sit astride that log and be taken down by the current. But then putting a mast up and getting a sheepskin or some animal skin and attaching it to the mast. And then by manoeuvring that, you can determine which way the, quote, boat, unquote, travels. And so you've got motion. You can control the speed and the direction it goes, all thanks to this invisible thing, the wind. And that was the beginning of harnessing the wind. And of course, we see that single mast now in the Nile, with the felucca, the boats you see off Luxor. And then in the Pacific, the Polynesians put on an outrigger so that when the wind is powerful and the boat is leaning over, it doesn't capsize. And they became the most skilled of all navigators. And then you get the big square riggers. And so that particular area of harnessing the wind to travel across the seas becomes crucially important until the age of sail ended in the 19th century. James Watt invented the steam engine, and then you have powered boats. So wind from the get-go, from 4,500 years BCE, was used usefully to travel. Did many other things, but travel was the first thing.
Yes. Let me bring listeners into the conversation. Listeners, does your work or play rely on the wind? When do you really notice it? Have the Diablo winds or the Santa Ana winds shaped your experience of living in California? When has the wind scared or soothed you? You can tell us by emailing forum@kqed.org, finding us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We're talking with Simon Winchester, a journalist and author whose new book is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind. And Simon, I want to ask you about a major historical event that was essentially exposed because of the wind, and that is the Chernobyl nuclear disaster.
I remember this only too well. I was living in Oxford in England at the time, and I was in the kitchen making a cup of coffee when the BBC, which seldom breaks into its afternoon broadcasting, did so and said that authorities in Sweden have discovered a plume of radiation whose signature suggests it's the result of a nuclear catastrophe somewhere, has been detected just north of Stockholm. Where had it come from? Well, the winds that day, and it was April 1986, were coming into Sweden from the southeast. And so they tracked it, this plume of radiation across the Baltic, across Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, across the Iron Curtain, which then existed because this was the time of the Soviet Union, to the west of the USSR, specifically the southwest, specifically Ukraine, more specifically still to a power station which they knew existed in this little town near Pripyat called Chernobyl. And Moscow, of course, said nothing. Nothing to see here. No, nothing's happened at all. Move on. But we knew that something had happened. And the wind changed slightly and blew this plume of very dangerous radiation over Germany, Poland, touching northern France, touching even the United Kingdom. And people were told not to drink milk and to be sensible. The extraordinary thing is that, and eventually the Russians said, yes, something has happened. And in fact, we need help. Normally, the wind over the Ukraine in April blows from the west. And had it been blowing from the west on that particular day, then the radiation plume from the explosion in reactor number 4 would have blown over the Urals, over the steppes of western Siberia, ultimately to the deserts of Kazakhstan, and nobody outside the Soviet Union would have any idea that anything untoward had happened. Gorbachev said some years later that the collapse of the Soviet Union, which happened just a scant 5 years later, was triggered by the explosion at Chernobyl. And so weirdly, that profoundly important event, which affected the whole world and is still doing, as we know only too well today, was caused, was triggered, was exposed to the world by a fickle wind. It should have been from the west. It happened to be from the southeast. It was gentle. It was not a major wind, but it points out the fact that even a gentle wind can have profound effects.
Yeah. Wow. You warn us that trying to understand the mechanics of wind is a bit daunting, but do remind us of generally what causes it and the main attributes of wind.
Well, I mean, the person that really got it in one was the cleverest person of all time, I think Aristotle. And he wrote, 300 years BCE, so not that long ago compared to the Sumerians. He wrote in this massive tome, Meteorologica, that the wind was simply caused by heating of the atmosphere, which caused in that particular part of the world where it was happening, the air column to rise and then cooler air to rush in to fill the void from the cooler air around. And that movement of air, and that's how the OED defines wind, the movement of air, it's as simple as that, but caused by heat. So you need just two things, an atmosphere and a source of heat. So Aristotle nailed it. Basically nothing, I mean, it's become tremendously mathematical since, but it just underlines the point of what an incredibly clever chap Aristotle was. He got it. Air moving upwards, the gap being filled by air moving horizontally. That is wind.
Yeah. And all wind has speed, direction, pressure, and force.
Except not on the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire when I went there for my 80th birthday, the windiest place in the world, which had a recorded wind speed 231 miles an hour. Actually, one Australian place has bettered that in the last decade. I went there for my birthday, 28th September, 22 years ago anyway. And that particular day, there was no wind at all the meters. It was like seeing a speedometer on a stopped car. I said, what's going on? And the observers, there are always two observers up there at any time, they looked very sheepish. The windiest place in the world today has no wind.
After the break, I really want to get into that a little bit. What it means, is this just a one-off or unusual event, or does it mark something bigger? We'll talk about that right after the break. Listeners, we're talking with Simon Winchester about his new book, The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind, and we'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for KQED today comes from the historic San Jose Civic presenting Dave Koz and Friends Christmas Tour with special guests Jonathan Butler, Haley Reinhardt, Casey Abrams, and Kayla Waters live on December 21st. Tickets available now at sanjosecivic.com. Support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More at kia.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. A closely watched special election in Middle Tennessee could affect the balance of power in the House. It's a district President Trump won by 22 points last year, but Republicans are fighting to hold on. We'll take stock of the results next time on Here and Now.
That's coming up. Also, hackers, cybercrime, and AI. Also on Here and Now. All the news, too, starting at 11.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the wind this hour and how it's shaped our lives and our planet and how it's potentially shifting with climate change with Simon Winchester, who's written The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind. You may know him from other books, which include The Professor and the Madman, A Tale of Murder and Sanity, The Making of the Oxford English Dictionary, and A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. He'll also be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 6 and at Rakestraw Books in Danville tomorrow at 7. But he's here with us now, and listeners, tell us, when has the wind scared or soothed you? When have you really noticed it? And does your work or play rely on the wind? The email address, forum at kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum or call us at 866-733-6786. A listener writes, the most intense wind I've ever experienced was on a remote island in the Philippines. A typhoon came out of nowhere. I could barely stand up and had to go into the ocean and swim in 6-foot waves, to swim with the help of the wind to drift south to my hotel and avoid getting hit by flying coconuts. Very scary. Another listener writes, when I lived in SoCal, the Santa Ana winds were very strong. They made me feel very, very restless.
You know what Raymond Chandler said, famous quote, and you'll have to forgive the sexism in it, but he said, when the Santa Ana wind is blowing, normally docile housewives remove from the kitchen drawer the sharpest knife, finger lovingly its edge, and look lovingly at the back of their husband's necks.
Wow. Well, you certainly note the incredible destructive power of the Santa Anas and the most recent fires, of course, that we had in Southern California. An effect that you referenced that the wind really did have on the destructiveness of that fire. And so are winds, you know, do they have the potential with climate change to be much stronger, more damaging?
They do. And there's this very interesting duality about this that the listener who rang just now about the Philippines, the typhoons, they are getting much, much stronger and more frequent. And that's true with all cyclonic movements around the world, whether they're called hurricanes or whether they're called cyclones or whether they're called typhoons. But at the same time, and this is what I think fascinated me at the beginning and prompted me to decide to write the book, was that since 1985, statisticians have noticed that the average wind speed, not the extreme, but the average wind speed, initially over continental Europe and then over the continents of Northern America, have actually declined by a substantial percentage. I mean, 10-12%. The average wind speed has gone down. And this phrase was born, that the world seems to be in the grip of what they call the great terrestrial stilling.
Yes.
And a phenomenon known as wind droughts, places that normally were windy. I mean, a classic example is Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii is in the belt where the trade winds, these absolutely constant northeast trade winds, known as the trade winds because cargo ships could always rely on them blowing. Well, Honolulu Airport used to have about 330 trade wind days that they would record where the winds were blowing lustily. Now that's dropped in the last 10 years to something like 250. So for some reason, the wind in the North Pacific has been declining. Why this is happening is a matter of intense debate in the meteorological community, and it gets very technical and also, I think, rather implausible. They say the increasing roughness of the solid world, new buildings, skyscrapers interrupting the flow of winds, like newly formed mountains are going up and causing the wind to be much more erratic. But then again, they say it's the changing differential between the temperature of the equator and the temperature of the poles brought about by global warming. But interestingly, as I was coming to finish the book, the very same statisticians who were saying the wind speeds are declining, they're saying quite the reverse. Well, they're actually picking up again. No need to worry. And so a new phrase has been born. It used to be global terrestrial stilling. Now, even more unseemly, global terrestrial reacceleration. That's what we're in a period of at the moment. So it's a confusing world.
Yeah, so the jury is essentially out on this.
Very much out, yeah.
Mm. Well, let me go to some calls. Lisa in San Francisco is on the line. Hi, Lisa, join us.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the call. Love this conversation. And in my, we lived in San Francisco, where I was raised. We lived on Dominica, at the bottom of the Caribbean, between Martinique and Guadeloupe, and had lived there since 2015. And in 2017, obviously, with Hurricane Maria, we left. So I just felt a kindred spirit to this conversation in which the winds still your heart and move you gently on a boat, and then move a community off a mountain into the sea, taking everybody and everything with it. All are possible. And so now, when I'm around really hard winds, I'm not scared so much because they're not probably going to get to 180 miles an hour.
Mm. Lisa, thank you for sharing that experience and also, of course, underscoring the incredible duality of the wind that Simon has been talking about.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that my first experience of the doldrums was on this little schooner. I had never really sailed before, but this was an Australian skipper who was doing a round-the-world trip and invited me on for a few thousand miles and taught me navigation, taught me how to sail. And believe you me, off the coast of South Africa, we ran into phenomenal storms. And when you're in a tiny little schooner facing huge squalls, which then turn out into almighty, you know, with the boat leaning over, just almost the mast touching the surface of the sea, you feel very lonely. As the Basque fisherman used to say, how tiny my boat, how vast the sea, how huge the wind, and makes you feel so puny, so insignificant. But then all can change 24 hours later, and suddenly the wind is a magical thing, and it's, if you're anywhere near the land, you can smell the flowers on the shore, you can, it's just wonderful. So the mixture between utter terror and an idyll is what makes the, one of the many, many things that makes the wind such a fascinating subject.
Yeah. Let me go to David next in Santa Rosa. Hi, David, you're on.
Good morning. I also grew up on a sailboat at various times in my younger years and have sailed all over the Western Hemisphere. And it was always something to be respected and appreciated and never underestimated. And then in 2017, I live in Santa Rosa, and of course, I was one of the people who lost my home in the fire. Since then, I've worked as a volunteer with fire survivors of seven other fires. In Santa Rosa, there were three fires that I met with people who were coming out of the blaze and who had been affected significantly by the fires. And then in Boulder, Colorado, and in Maui, and twice in both in West LA and in Pasadena. Of course, every one of these fires is wind driven. And the increase of the wind and I think the lack of respect for the wind conditions is what's going to be behind future fires as well. It seems as though, and I appreciate input on this, my perspective is that the conditions in Maui that made the Maui fire perfect, the windward side of the island is wet. The wind comes in wet off the ocean, drops the water on the windward side, goes up over the old cone of the volcanoes and down the other side dry. And it comes down into Lahaina as a dry, fire prone wind. I think that condition is also present on each of the other islands.
It is also, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Please, Simon.
It also, in Lahaina, it had this extraordinary phenomenon of rushing down from the hill, getting to the ocean side, and then a great reversal took place. It started blowing back towards the city and further destroying what hadn't already been destroyed. It behaved in a peculiar way, and the people in Boulder at the big atmospheric laboratory there have been studying it with fascination because it's a new kind of wind phenomenon. And the whole business of gusts, we don't think of gusts, why they're caused. There's a very interesting piece of research, I mean, nothing to do with death and destruction, how birds manage gusts. They look at the behavior of owls flying in wind tunnels, and they suddenly insert a gust and see how the owl manages to continue flying in a straight line and deals with that in a very interesting mechanical way using its wings. The subtleties of winds are what fascinates me. Tragically, operating in Lahaina, benign, amusingly, in how owls fly.
Do you think there's something to what David's saying, that we have a general lack of respect for the power of the wind here?
I totally do. We have total lack of respect for it. Well, because we have, I wouldn't say little understanding of it. I think we generally know why winds blow, but why they blow in what seems such an erratic way. I mean, I live in western Massachusetts, and to the west, I live in an old farmhouse. There is a line of pine trees, which was put up in the 19th century to protect my farm from the prevailing westerly winds. FDR, in a moment of, I think, of tremendous genius, he halted the Dust Bowl excesses of the 1930s, which ruined hundreds of farms in Nebraska and the Dakotas by planting what was called a shelter belt. 220 million trees were planted in a line from a town, oddly enough, called Willow, Oklahoma, where the first one, it wasn't a willow, it was a cottonwood, I think. 220 million trees in a great line all the way up to the Dakotas. That effectively controlled the wind. It respected it. We said, we know you're blowing, but we're going to slow you down and thereby save the farms. He did it. So understanding the wind, respecting it, you can turn it to your advantage, somewhat.
Yes. Let me go next to Caitlin in Santa Rosa. Hi, Caitlin. Join us.
Oh, hi. I know the rest of the conversation has been much more serious, but I just wanted to kind of share a fun thing about the wind, which is that my kids and I, when it's a windy day, we like to run into the wind, and when it blows your hair and blows your clothes, you can pretend like you're running super fast, and it's just a fun way that we just have a good time and play with wind. So I just wanted to share that.
Delightful. And of course, playing with wind, you think of wind chimes, you think of the singing sands, and you think, at least I thought in the book, of the reed and blowing through our mouths. And that we can produce a wind of up to 25 miles an hour by blowing. Blow it onto a reed, blow it onto a double reed, and you can get the oboe and the most ethereally beautiful sounds conjured by wind, blowing down a tube with a skilled player, of course. Just another way in which moving air, which after all is what wind is, can be brought to our advantage.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, we have a clip of the Death Valley Eureka Dunes, which I think have been described as singing sands. So we'll hear a little bit of the hum right now. So talk a little bit about the singing sand dunes and the phenomenon that's happening there.
Well, a famous book, Josephine Tay, The Singing Sands is the title. It's a detective thriller set in western Scotland. I used to live on an island called the Isle of Ling near Oban. Go a little bit further out to Barra and Mingalay and the Outer Hebrides, you get tons and tons of islands that have singing sands. The big expert on sand dunes was a very sort of stuffy British brigadier called Ralph Bagnold, who was, there's a wonderful picture of him in the book. His entire career was formed when he was a soldier fighting behind German lines in Libya in the 1940s during the Second World War. And he became enraptured by the fact that sand, which he described as snow that doesn't melt, can behave, particularly if the grains are of a certain size and of a certain sphericity, jostling against one another, whether under your feet as you walk, whether under a camel's feet as it walks, or whether when the wind is blowing, they can squeak, they can boom, they can be choral, rather like what we've just
or
heard.
Or buzz, it almost like bees there.
Or like bees, exactly. But it's a beautiful thing to hear, and there are only a relatively few places in the world where the sound is dry enough and the sphericity is pure enough that it can produce notes. Equally, there's a passage which fascinates me, a BBC producer called Tim Dee, who wanted to know what the noise of the wind itself is, because what we hear, of course, is the wind causing things passing through trees, you know, the rustling of leaves or the singing of sounds. But what does wind itself sound like? And so he took a microphone, very sensitive microphone, and walked to that part of eastern England known as the Wash, which people may remember was where King Canute put his throne and forbade the sea to advance towards him, but the sea ignored him totally and it nearly drowned him. So Tim went and stood with his microphone as high in the air as possible, knowing full well that the wind, it was a northeasterly coming from the high Arctic, there was nothing between him and the source of the wind but 1,000 miles of ocean. What did it sound like? And when he played the tape back, he got it, what many writers have said, it is the sound only of souls leaving the earth, going out into space. It's a wonderful poetic moment.
Very poetic, very poetic. Listeners, have you been to or lived in a place remarkable for its wind and maybe the sound it makes, like the Singing Sands or Tornado Alley? When do you really notice the wind? How have the winds shaped your life living here? Maybe your work or play relies on the wind. Maybe it often scares or soothes you. Listener Caroline writes, I ride a horse and whenever it's windy, all the horses are restless and jumpy. Can you talk a little bit about the wind's ability to alter moods? Because we're also getting a couple of these types of comments about the way we feel.
Well, we talked briefly about the Santa Ana, which clearly, at least in Raymond Chandler's view,
yes,
turns the mood. But the place renowned in the world is Provence, southern France, the Mistral blowing from the northwest down into southern France and to Marseille. That undeniably, I mean, I was there doing research and then moving on to Trieste, where there's this famous, extraordinary wind called the Bora, to which there is dedicated a museum, the Musée du Bora. But going back to the Mistral, the mood changing, the judges, it is said, I think this is somewhat apocryphal, take a somewhat lenient view of domestic violence because it is said that the Mistral, when it's blowing, causes people to turn mad, to turn ugly, and they will, the judges will rule some degree of leniency if you
what?
Murder, I know, terrible thing to say, you murder your spouse and you say, well, the wind made me do it. Ah, well, yes, it's a Mistral. Okay, well, don't do it again, kind of thing.
You've got to be kidding.
Not entirely.
Oh, no. Ah, let me go to caller Frey in Hayward. Oh, Frey, quickly, please. I just realized we're coming up on a break.
Hi, so I'm actually a flight instructor, and I just wanted to share that I learned how to fly in East Kansas, where the wind is very strong, and it creates a challenging environment. I remember one particular day where the wind was gusting at over 33 knots, and my flight instructor and I then decided to not fly because it was scarily unsafe to a certain point. But now that I'm working as a flight instructor here in the East Bay and Hayward in San Jose, I noticed that our airports have very mild winds in comparison, which makes a very welcoming environment for new students who are trying to get used to the idea of handling an airplane without the added hassle of strong winds.
Ah, yeah, your work really is sensitive to the wind.
Colleen, I tried and I didn't continue with it. The mantra, you know, takeoff is optional, but landing is compulsory. That troubled me, particularly when the wind was blowing over 33 knots.
We'll have more with Simon Winchester about the wind after the break. This is Forum. Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Guy Marzorati, the clock is ticking on healthcare. With federal subsidies set to expire at the end of the month, 22 million Americans could soon see their healthcare premiums more than double. Senate Republicans are floating plans to redirect funds into health savings accounts or dismantle the marketplace entirely. Meanwhile, Democrats push to extend the tax credits. The White House remains unpredictable. We'll look at the proposals and how the vote could shape the 2026 midterms. For past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. You're actually listening to a recording of San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge making a whistling noise during high winds in June of 2020. We're playing it for you because we're talking about the wind today with Simon Winchester. His new book is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind. And listeners, you are sharing when the wind has scared or soothed you, the types of wind events you've lived through, or maybe lack of wind events that you lived through, like a stifling heat wave, about the moments when you really notice the wind, especially if it plays a role in your work or in the types of things you do for play. The email address is forum@kqed.org. Find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum. Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And speaking of sound, this listener writes, I'm more of a breeze person. I love a cool breeze on a warm day and the sound of it blowing through the leaves of my bamboo. Let me go to Alex in Half Moon Bay. Hi, Alex. You're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
I'm wonderful. I'm calling in, currently checking the surf in the north end of Half Moon Bay, and I've been listening to the stories, as I think it's to be expected, of the Santa Anas and, you know, fires and kind of all the horrific things that come from strong gusts of wind. I just want to give another perspective. Here, I'm from Half Moon Bay, a little beach south of town, but it's been offshore, which means the wind blows from the shore to the ocean, which is ideal for surfing, right? And so, the last few years, I was in Southern California, and whenever the Santa Anas would blow, you know, people were freaking out. There are all sorts of rumors and kind of pseudoscience, I think, about how it would change the molecular biology of an atom and how it would, you know, change the charge and everything, and that's why it causes static electricity and all these things. I'm not sure how true that is. But for surfers, they weren't the devil winds. As my friend put it, they're quite angelic because it blows into the wind, making conditions better, right? And that's how you could get tubed to get barreled. And for us, it was very idyllic when these blew, and it feels horrible to be, you know, enjoying a wind that's causing a lot of suffering at the time, not always. Yeah. But for us, it was great. And I had one quick story about the Santa Anas themselves. My first daughter was due in late November, and I remember taking a hike with my wife the night before, and we were up in the mountains, and we turned around with the onshores blowing, meaning coming down from the northwest, and on the hike back, I felt a familiar hot gust of wind in my face, and that was the Santa Anas blowing, and I knew the surf would be good, so the next morning, we got good waves, and that evening, my wife went into labor. and I'm not just once, I should say, in March, which is not too common for Santa Anas in Southern California. Again, we've got a kind of strange Santa Ana gust wind for a day and a half. And then my second daughter was born 2 weeks early.
Wow.
Did you call her either Anna or Gail or something appropriate?
You know, my wife's water broke at dawn, so our first one's Aurora.
That's all right. Interestingly, about if I can talk briefly about onshore and offshore winds, Benjamin Franklin was one of the first people to realize the frustrating power. He wasn't a surfer, as you may remember, trying to get from England. He was working as a in his youth as a printer's apprentice in London and was trying to get back to the Chesapeake Bay. And he left from a port in southern England and was something like 2 weeks in the English Channel because he could never get free from the stickiness, as it were, of the onshore and offshore winds, which drove him every time his little boat was trying to get westward. It would drive him northwards into various bays in Dorset and Devon and Hampshire and so forth. And he finally got into the open ocean and then whizzed across in about 25 days, I think, to the Chesapeake. But he wrote with great frustration about how my trip across the Atlantic to the New World was frustrated by these beastly onshore and offshore winds in wretched England.
Well, Alex, I think you've got someone who shares your love of the wind, finds them less wretched. Dan writes, as a lifelong surfer, I always looked forward to feeling the wind blowing into my bedroom window, indicating the east wind or offshore wind, the feeling of fall in San Francisco. You know, building on the benefits of the wind, you do write extensively about wind power and have made some discoveries about it, including that it's been a target of fossil fuel proponents for a very, very long time.
Much longer than we thought, at least I initially thought. The first man really to invent wind power was a man called James Blythe, who was an engineer in Scotland. And by this time, this was in the 1870s, already Faraday had come up with the idea of electrical generation by spinning a copper wire between the poles of a magnet, so that we knew what to do. And Edison had just invented the light bulb. It was now a question of how to rotate that spindle. And Blythe, who lived in a village called Marykirk in eastern Scotland, where there was constant wind, said, well, you know, windmills that, you know, create flour as opposed to power, why don't I try that? So he built a windmill in his front garden and then later put it on his roof, using it to turn a spindle, which rotated the coil between the magnet. And sure enough, it generated reliable electricity, which he stored in a battery. Those days it was called an accumulator. And tons of electricity. I mean, more than he knew what to do with. He had something like 25 Edison light bulbs. He lit his bedroom. He dined at night not by fluttering candlelight, but by generated electric light. And he thought, I can give this away. So he went down the street to his neighbors and said, look, I can give you bulbs, because I've got a lot of them, and I can also give you a battery filled with wind-generated electricity. And to a man, his neighbor said, ach, no, it's Mr. Blythe, that's very nice of you, but wind-generated, it's the work of the devil. And the reason they said it was the work of the devil was that they believed, or were told to believe, that only electricity generated from coal, which underlaid the village of Marykirk, and the coal mine owners were powerful people in the community, they told us that wind-generated electricity is no good. Only coal-generated electricity is.
Wow.
So the power of the fossil fuel lobby, which we know is doing great damage to the wind power industry today, was hard at work in the 1880s. Nothing new under the sun.
Wow. What do you think about the trajectory of wind power? Because, yes, the fossil fuel industry is a very powerful, as you say, opponent. But at the same time, you also have people who are very concerned about the birds who are dying as a result of them, or some people even just don't like the noise or the way that they look and so on. And so I'm just wondering what you think of, you know, the trajectory of wind power as a power source here. We also happen to have an administration that seems pretty unfriendly.
Well, to me, I mean, of course, there are downsides and whales and birds, but if you paint every other blade black, apparently it has a beneficial effect and not too many birds are killed as a result. But yes, I mean, it happens, but cost-benefit analysis, fossil fuels are evil and do huge damage to the planet as a whole. There will be some local damage, sure, to certain specific niches of the environment, but I don't mean to be in any sense callous, but the overall benefit, to me anyway, of wind power generation is you can't really contradict it. Solar power, I'm less happy with because of the cost of actually producing the solar panels themselves. Hydropower is absolutely tremendous and a very good idea. I'm getting into trouble here. Something of a supporter of nuclear power generation. But wind just seems logical. It's there, it's free, it's eternal. Providing we're not going to experience stilling, then I think we should support it and oppose the fossil fuel industry's attempts to stifle it.
We're talking with Simon Winchester about the wind and how it shapes our lives, how it shapes our planet, and how it generates tremendous power. His book is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind, and you, our listeners, are sharing your experiences of the wind, including Sonia, who writes, I live amidst the trees and see the wind every day when the beautiful tree shadows dance on my walls. Another listener writes, when I was quite young, I lived on the outskirts of a small town with no one to play with. The wind became my only friend as I listened to it blow through the trees. To this day, when it blows, no matter how hard, I feel like I am with an old friend.
That's so lovely.
Very. Laura in Oakland, you're on. Join us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest. And I grew up on Puget Sound and up in the San Juan Islands. And we got storms. And when the storms would come in, when the wind would come first, and
Laura, I'm so sorry. It seems like we're having an issue with your connection. Can you call us back? In the meantime, let me go next to Randy in San Jose. Hi, Randy, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to talk about the winds in Denver, they're kind of like the Santa Ana winds, but nice. They come start up on top of the Rocky Mountains where it's really, really cold. And then they come down into the Platte River into Denver, and it gets to a balmy 40, 50 degrees. Very nice. Where up just tens of miles away on the plains, it'll be sub-zero. And so it makes Denver kind of pleasant in the winter instead of sub-zero because of the essentially the equivalent, I don't know what they call them there, but it's the equivalent of the Santa Ana wind. Mm.
And these winds that come from the top of the mountains cascading down, so-called catabatic winds, the most notorious, and I mentioned it earlier, is the Bora in Trieste, this most peculiar city at the upper end of the Adriatic Sea, which used to be the port for Austria, which one tends to think of as a landlocked country, but it used to have a navy, used to have a port. Trieste has its own political story, but its most interesting story is the Bora, and so fierce is the Bora when it's blowing in February and March that the city authorities affix stout ropes to the utility poles so that if it happens to blow when you're trying to cross a street, you cling on for dear life. And people, you see them being blown so fiercely that they, providing they hold on, are themselves horizontal until the gust ends and they regain their footsteps and they can continue shopping. It's a merciless wind, once experienced, never forgotten.
I think we have Laura back now. Laura, let's try now. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest, Puget Sound and the San Juan Islands. And when the storms would come in on the Sound, the wind was first, and it would bring huge waves. And this incredible wind that would just wreck powerfully around you, and I would go sit on the seawall with the waves just crushing in. And when it would finally start to rain, you could go up in the mountains to the forest, and it was like a chorus. Huh. It was musical. The sound of the wind coming through the trees as it would change direction and move around.
Yes.
And it was like in a cathedral. And it's, I get choked up when I think about it now because it's such a, wind for me, for my life, it was my favorite time of year. I just reveled in that wind.
Oh, Laura, I'm so glad you called back.
The connection between winds and waves is a fascinating one, and it became historically important in 1944 because the D-Day planners who were going to send hundreds of thousands of men to land on the shores, including my father, who was a young lieutenant in those days in the army, how high were the waves going to be? And this remarkable man, Walter Monk, who was down at La Jolla in Southern California, said, and he was a great expert on the correlation between wind and waves, said that they're going to be too high on the 5th of June, which was the date that Eisenhower planned Operation Overlord, which was the name of the operation. And he said there are two storms coming down from Baffin Island, going to make the waves particularly violent on the 5th, postpone it for 24 hours. And Eisenhower, against the advice of all his generals, who were just itching to go, said, OK, we'll listen to you. And so Walter Monk is a great hero. That's why the 6th of June, 1944, was D-Day. Didn't do my father much good. He was captured and spent the rest of the war in prison. Oh. But nonetheless, the 6th of June is a wind-related event with the orders sent or the suggestions made from California.
Well, maybe there's some hope for us respecting the wind after all, we humans. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Heather writes, when I was a teenager, I had a boyfriend who was a windsurfer. Back then, you could dial the weather service to hear the wind speeds, and I would know if I would see him that day. I was seethingly jealous of the wind. Simon, I learned a new word from your book, Anemochori? Am I saying that right?
Anemochori, yeah.
The dispersal of seeds by the wind. Help me appreciate this phenomenon.
Well, all sorts. I mean, the ethos of a plant, when it's ready to germinate and send its seeds somewhere, is that send them as far away from itself as possible so you don't get a little clump. Get them 50 feet away or 500 feet or a mile away. And there are mechanisms, of course, animals or, well, you know, our coats getting the seeds on them and dropping them a mile away when we go for a walk. That's all fine and good, but why not use the wind? And so a lot of plants devised their seed structures, the sycamore being an obvious, it had little helicopters that are taken up by the wind and then float down maybe a mile away from the mother sycamore. But a most dramatic example, I think, is and as far as the United States is concerned, not a particularly good outcome, is tumbleweed.
Mm.
Tumbleweed, basically, we blame a chap called Henry Schatz, who was a farmer in Dakota Territory, in now South Dakota, and he was, you know, had come from Germany. It was a typical, you know, Willa-Cather type Nebraska plains farmer. Alfalfa, sorghum, not making much money. And he read somewhere that perhaps if I plant flax, so he wrote to his seedsman in St. Paul, Minnesota, I think it was, ordering flax seed. And they said, OK, we'll order you a 100-pound bag, and it'll take some while to get to you, about 6 months. And 6 months later, a big bag of seeds arrived. What he didn't notice was it said, presumably in Cyrillic, that their port of origin was Odessa. They had come all the way from the Black Sea and through Istanbul and the Mediterranean and so forth. And so he sowed, he broadcast, as you're doing today, the seed in his 5 acres. And unbeknownst to him, but the forensic botanists have worked out that within the great mass of flax seeds were six small yellow seeds with a completely different kind of plant. It wasn't flax at all. It was something called Salsola tragus, the Siberian, the Russian or the Ukrainian thistle. And these plants grew among the original flax, and they were soft and pliable and rather nice, and the Hereford cattle munched on them. But then they grew spiky and woody, and nothing wanted to eat them. And they grew hugely until they formed great balls about 2 or 3 feet in diameter. And come October, they broke off from their stems, and the northeasterly winds, which blew over the prairies in those days, and still do, of course, started bouncing these things along. What they didn't realize that within each of these balls, which is a classic tumbleweed, an icon of most Western movies, each of these balls contained within itself 150 to 200,000 new seeds. Wow. And so wherever they bounced, they left a trail of potential new Salsola tragus, Ukrainian thistles behind. It's subsequently become the most invasive botanical phenomenon in American history. And now, when new urban developers in places like Provo in Utah and the suburbs of Santa Fe build cul-de-sacs, particularly if they're facing into the northeast, they get piled up with huge 10, 20-foot walls of tumbleweed, which is now no longer an iconic and amusing symbol of the West. It's a darn nuisance, and you have to get goats to eat them or trucks to carry them away.
Ah, once again, the dual nature of the wind to create, to grow, and to destroy and become a nuisance. Simon Winchester, thanks so much for helping us appreciate it today.
Great pleasure.
And thanks also to our listeners for helping us appreciate the wind as well. Susie Britton produced this segment. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
KQED traffic is next with Elaine Leung. She has details about two crashes in Mountain View.
That's right, Dave. Two minor incidents. North 85 approaching North 101. Looks like five cars in total. The good news, they're all off on the right shoulder, so lanes are not blocked. It is slow from Moffitt Boulevard. Heading out for the Bay Bridge, it's improving. We'll call it a minor backup at the toll plaza. We do have traffic slow top of the incline, off and on slow, heading into San Francisco. It will loosen up ultimately once you're beyond the Central Freeway. And Mass Transit, we're on time. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Transit and traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from the Watermark at San Jose, offering assisted living and memory care with amenities like a fitness and wellness center, massage therapy room, a salon, and on-site restaurants. Located in Silicon Valley, learn more at San Jose.